Welcome, subscribers. We are talking to Michael Tsarion, and I would like to begin today to spend a little time speaking about Theosophy and its founder, Helena Blavatsky. I myself have not read that much about Theosophy, but I have read enough to understand that there are some very interesting ideas and concepts expressed in Theosophy. And there is also a lot of controversy, of course, and I know that Michael have kind of brushed on these topics in his talks. And when I myself began reading a lot about the New Age and the conspiracies around that, I pretty early bumped up against the work of Blavatsky, and a lot of researchers are, you know, kind of giving her a bad rap, so to speak. But I have a few ideas why that might be, but let me ask you, Michael, why is it, do you think, that she and her work has gotten, I guess, attacked so much?
Because people haven't read her work.
That's a good answer.
Anyway, it's nice to get a chance to talk with you about this because, you know, it is a tangled web. There's no doubt about it that the Theosophical Society is a completely different creature after, you know, Blavatsky died.
Yeah.
It became a different creature after Krishnamurti, you know, went his own way, and he wouldn't buy into the whole, you know, orthodoxy of it.
Yeah.
So it changed again, and people didn't listen to Krishnaji when he tried to disband it. Of course, everyone who was so... It's just like anything that people are into for sort of a social point of view, or they're worshipping some guru, you know,
yeah.
They didn't listen to what the man said. They didn't disband. They said, well, let him go his own way, and we'll just stay with what we've got.
Yeah.
So they stayed with the trappings, and the spiritual leaders had left.
Hmm.
And this is what happens, you know, when sort of you have Hamlet without the hero.
Yeah, the driving...
Kind of a book is Hamlet without Hamlet.
Yeah.
So the leaders go their own way because these are people who are vital and they're alive and they're into the true chi of it. They're in with the muse. And then that dries up. And then you have the edifice. You have this, you know, fossil that just persists and persists. And basically what happened with Theosophy is what happens with a lot of groups. When the second and third, you know, lieutenants took over...
Mm.
They did not have the direct connection to the muse.
Hmm.
Because in life, it's a strange quirk of fate that the muse only works through the individual shaman.
Yeah.
This is just the way it is. You know, in the tribe, you have crazy horse. Yeah, there's one crazy horse. You know, there's one Buddha that sits under the tree. There's one Jesus on the cross.
Yeah.
There's one Odin. You know, it's a very singular thing. There's only one Merlin. You know, one Gandalf. It's like, it's a very much a singular thing.
Yeah.
And that person may then, out of the goodness and the virtue that is in them, expand that to create a circle of friends or a order, a sect,
yeah,
a group, you know, because this is sometimes an extension of a person's own dharma.
Yeah.
I mean, and their own, you know, vision. And that can be, you know, it's not for us to comment on whether that should be done because whatever guides a person, and especially in the Victorian era, there was a tremendous sense that, you know, the world was changing. They were coming up to the end of the millennium in the 19th century, and people felt a lot of big changes. And remember, people didn't just sit watching TV all day. You had some of the greatest writers, some of the greatest occultists, you know, people like Conan Doyle, the writer of Sherlock Holmes, was a member of the Order of the Golden Dawn.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you had W.B. Yeats. You had Walter Macken. You know, you had so many ordinary scholars and writers in the secular world, but they were becoming members of these secret societies and fraternities for the good of mankind.
That's very interesting. Yeah, because it feels like, again, this was a point I was going to bring up, because there seems to be a kind of surge, at least in the Western esoteric movements, as you say, in the late, I guess, 18th century and from there onwards. And as you say, many of these, I think, it was started out on a really, you know, with good intentions in a lot of cases. But as always, it seems like these movements actually are being hijacked further down the road. Do you
well,
agree on
yes.
that? Yeah.
And it's in two phases. One happens is when the person who's the real brains either passes away or, you know, becomes too much of a hermit. This is what happened with, you know, the Rajneesh group.
Yeah,
with
yeah.
Osho, you know, it happens
Osho.
All across the board, you know.
Yeah.
So if that person topples or they leave the game, then all the little lieutenants and the scurrying ants all then want to sort of compete for, you know, the control.
Yeah.
And it becomes this ridiculous thing. And the thing with theosophy, particularly, is that it then started to become more of a political movement than it did a spiritual movement.
Yeah.
And the reason why I detest people who blame Blavatsky for the machinations of the Theosophical and Fabian Society are people who, for a start, have never read her work, and two, they do not understand that this woman spent her life trying to excise any type of political, social wrangling and maneuvering to contaminate the true spiritual essence of what she was saying. So you don't even have to be into her spirituality. You can like it or not like it.
Yeah.
But this woman was a spiritualist.
Yeah.
This is a woman who climbed out of her own window in Russia instead of getting married at 18 and walked to Tibet. Right? This is a person
yeah.
who left the tiny microscopic, you know, xenophobic, limited life that she was being promised as a young girl
yeah.
and had a greater vision and took herself off and walked all the way from Russia to Tibet to find out the meaning of life.
Amazing.
Right there, when you hear that story, I'm interested. I want to know more about such a person who would want to do that.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So this is a person who then goes on to create an order. When she finally dies, the place is taken over by Annie Besant and other people who were major political figures in England. And so their interest in taking the spiritual order, they have no spirit. So, of course, that's going to die a death. And then they have to replace it with some other agenda. So the Theosophical Society, which had many dukes and many princes and many of these royalty already involved because they did believe that the Messiah was coming, et cetera, et cetera. They were all looking to be enlightened by somebody else. You know, this is the whole thing.
Yeah.
But Blavatsky had always said that, you know, this is not a political movement, and she absolutely despised politics and knew that the politics was the control of what she called the black sorcerers.
Yeah, yeah.
She always talked about this, but the work that she wrote this in has been suppressed. Everyone has heard of her Isis Unveiled, the two volumes, and everybody has heard of the Secret Doctrine,
yeah.
the two volumes. But she wrote a third volume to the Secret Doctrine. It's Secret Doctrine Part 3, Volume 3.
Mm-hmm.
And in that is when she has her most, you know, pressing and most poignant attacks upon politics and upon the secret societies, specifically the Vatican and the Jesuits, but also the Masons and all of these other false Luciferian entities.
Yeah.
She was warning about this, and she was adamant that her society, you know, would not have a political role and start to get involved in world politics, because she saw that all as just nonsense.
Yeah.
She saw that as an expression of people who are caught in their lower ego drives, who are not attending to the work of their soul, and they're preoccupying themselves, you see, with all of this meaningless political machinations.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a power dynamic. You know, it's all based on power dynamics. And this is not what this person was about. Blavatsky was about enlightenment of the human race, not about, you know, hierarchies of control.
Yeah. So there might be a reason there right away to kind of pretty early on hijack this organization and let it afterwards represent something else, I guess. Do you know if it changed much after, you know, she died?
Yeah, I would say it radically changed. And some people even have speculated that her ill health in the end was maybe even something that was created artificially.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's very easy to read the profile of a teacher, of a master of that nature. They're hermits. They study and read all day. They're not interested in really, you know, pushing the administrative aspect because they want to do the spiritual work.
Yeah.
So they slowly, slowly leave the administration to these other people who maybe have vested interests. And, you know, it's like the old problem with Osho, where, you know, or Howard Hughes, they can be poisoned. They can be poisoned maybe even physically by the people around them.
Yeah.
And slowly put into bad health so that they cannot operate, you know. And, of course, see, the trouble with a virtuous person, one of the greatest problems with a person of the light, is that they project their own light on everybody that comes into their midst. They project their own virtue on the world. And they see everybody as being just as good as they are.
Yeah.
And this leaves them wide open then for, you know, for sabotage.
Yeah, absolutely.
So even if that didn't happen, well, then, you know, she died, and then Annie Besant and Leadbeater and the Webbs and all of these English Fabians that later became the Fabian Society, who were affiliated with theosophy or used theosophy,
yeah.
they used it because it's theosophy already had in it a tremendous amount of money. A lot of dukes and princes and nobility were involved. So it was very easy from that point on to say, co-opt the order and turn it to being this pusher of left-wing socialistic, you know, philosophy.
Yeah.
It became like an embryo under which the spiritualist groups hid. But these are individuals who had political aspirations, specifically Alice Bailey. Alice Bailey and her husband were major, you know, movers and shakers within the political upper echelons of the Russell Trust and the British secret establishment.
Yeah.
They had direct relationships to the, you know, the British royal family and so on and so forth. And Blavatsky never coveted any of these people. She loathed any of that stuff. Absolutely. You never saw her at Buckingham Palace shaking hands with Queen Victoria or any of this nonsense, you know?
Yeah.
She didn't care about any of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's very much like in Islam. They say that when anybody goes to Mecca, you know, I mean, Malcolm X found this out when he went, that one thing is, when you go to Mecca, everybody, no matter how rich they are, have to change their clothes, and they wear just a simple white robe, so that nobody has any distinction in at the moment when you're going to these great Muslim festivals, you know, in Iran and Persia. There was always a very ritualistic sort of shedding of your class status before you dare approach, you know, the tomb of the Prophet. So this was an Orthodox religion, and it's very much the same in the occult societies. And, of course, you see there's a lot of egomaniacal people who come from great wealth and great aristocracy who don't want to do that. They're thinking, why should I take off my slippers? Why should I not, you know, throw down my crown if I'm coming into the occult world?
Yeah.
I don't want to be faceless. I want to be acknowledged for who I am. I want to walk on a red carpet. You know, and slowly this is what then happens, is that these people want to use these occult orders for their own aggrandizement.
Yeah. Huh. And you know, there is, I don't know if this is fair then to say, but I mean, a lot of other people have done the connection to, you know, I guess we could go in two different areas. First, maybe we can touch upon Edward Bulwer Lytton. You know, he wrote a book called The Coming Race. And do you know if he in any way was involved in Theosophy?
Oh, yeah. He was a very close friend of G.R.S. Meade. G.R.S. Meade was a Blavatsky's secretary who went on to write lots and lots of interesting books.
Mm.
Bulwer Lytton was, you know, again, a highly aristocratic person who was initiated into some very powerful lodges. So these are people who had many affiliations outside of Theosophy. They also belong to Theosophy. So, you know, you might see Theosophy after their name. Oh, this was a member of the Theosophical Society. Mm. And people just leave it there.
Yeah.
What they don't realize is, yeah, this person was a member of Theosophy. He was also a member of the Freemasons. He was a member of the Luminous Lodge. He was a member of the Rosicrucians. I mean, is there a lodge in the world that some of these people were not, you know, involved with? But that doesn't mean that now you say that Theosophy is at fault.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, these are people who wined and dined with the queens and the kings. So what would you expect if people have been tracking any of the work that people like myself do? You know, it's almost like it's a redundant question. What would you expect from these people? These are people who are the aristocrats.
Yeah.
I'm always saying, listen, when I'm talking about masonry, don't be thinking I'm talking about the common or garden lodge on the street. I'm talking about bloodline masons.
Yeah.
So Madame Blavatsky was no bloodline mason. She was an ordinary woman, an ordinary girl who studied the great mysteries of life and traveled the world to find out what the secrets of life were.
Yeah.
She's no Bulwer Lytton. These are people who came from the absolute aristocracy, who wanted people like her out of the way. They might have even been very threatened by individuals like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they certainly were threatened by Krishnamurti. I mean, Krishnamurti has many times did talks in front of the United Nations. Do you know that? He used to, he actually was called many times to even address the groups with all the presidents.
Really?
In America were there to listen to his mystical, you know, teachings. And you know something? He used to get up and basically scream in their faces what a bunch of evil bastards they were. Oh, yeah, he's well known for really hammering these presidents and these dignitaries at these different seminars that were put on. He got into them about the violence and the corruption that was in their souls and stuff like that. He didn't, you know, just bow to them. So he threw, you know, he held up a big mirror to show who they were.
Yeah.
And this is not liked by these dignitaries. These dignitaries, you know, they're friends of the Pope, they're friends of the Queen. They don't want some, you know, mystical teacher who's independent, who really thinks for himself.
Yeah.
But they don't mind using the name of the order, saying, hey, look at my resume, I'm a member of this order. You know, the Golden Dawn has been slammed in the same way. The Golden Dawn was a very, very sacred organization. But, yeah, a lot of negative people joined that, who used it, you know, for their own aggrandizement and twisted it and turned it away from its original mystical, you know, tradition.
Yeah.
And then later on, you have then the third generation, who maybe, you know, 50, 100 years later, looking back at all of that going, oh my goodness, look at all those evil, you know, occult fraternities.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because...
And then, then you ask these people, hey, have you ever heard of Athenism? Or the Priory de Sion, or, you know, any, or the Knights Templar? They don't know anything about that.
Yeah.
So here they are, you know, yelling at some innocuous order that has really not much corruption in it, and yet these same people don't know about the real corruption that's in their midst.
Exactly.
You know, have you heard of Albert Pike? No. What was he? What about Giuseppe Manzini? What about the Bavarian Illuminati? You know, what about the Grand Orient Lodge of France? You want to talk evil societies? Listen, let's start. You know, but yeah. It's not theosophy.
Yeah.
Originally. These things get turned around. Just, it's exactly the same situation as when a great corporation that's founded by a great man, the man dies, and then the corporation, like Disney, for instance, is taken over by, you know, any number of different henchmen.
Yeah, yeah.
Each of which have complete power now, but they can also steer the whole thing in their direction. The corporation continues using the same name.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
And gets the blame. But wait a minute, you don't know who the brainchild is in the penthouse is who's now turning this particular, you know, edifice to do some very violent and dirty things.
You know, because it feels like a lot of, you know, as you said, this was a lot of British or English, you know, I guess royalty in that sense, or establishment coming into these kinds of organizations with, I guess, a rising background of you know, genetics and eugenics, and of course Darwinism was also on the rise in, I guess, in correlation with you know, books like The Coming Race and stuff like this. So I guess this was kind of merging together in one single idea and then gradually taking over. Because where I'm going with this, of course, obviously, is that many people have connected theosophy to be kind of the background to the occult aspects of Nazis or their ideology, basically.
No, it's not. Theosophy got created from the time of, you know, Madame Blavatsky and Rudolf Steiner.
Yeah.
And then into the Krishnamurti. But the occult methodologies and the occult philosophies that motivated the Nazis, that motivate the Illuminati, that motivate a lot of the government political bodies has far, far, far predates theosophy. Anybody who's really done their homework, you know, does not stop at theosophy. People who have not done their homework, you know, who maybe come into the subject for the first time, they get into it, they read a few books, they spot theosophy, and they go, okay, there it is. That's the brainchild.
Yeah.
You know, Madame Blavatsky didn't have any money. You know, her organization was funded by the royalty. She took, you know, donations, and the thing was kept alive. So these royalty who are giving the money, they think they own the club, and they do. It's only a matter of time before they sweep away the great thinker, and they go, hey, we own this.
Yeah.
And Krishnamurti's telling us to, you know, let it all go and follow your own bliss. Hey, we don't want anything to do with that. We like this club. It's great. It gives us a lot of prestige. You know, it's like the Bohemian Grove over there in, you know, America. They love to get together. Is it, you know, people will get together for the slightest thing. Well, this royalty, they love this feeling of this mystique and this occult, you know.
Yeah.
But when we're talking about the occult origins of politics, we're talking about Rome and Babylon and Egypt, you know, going back to the cult of Dionysus and the cult of Mithras.
Yeah.
Through, you know, the Orphites, all the way back to Alexandria, all the way back through the time of the Greeks' colonization of Alexander the Great into Egypt, and then back into the sun temples of Heliopolis. My God, you know, we're talking, you know, 5,000-6,000 years B.C.
Yeah, yeah.
These individuals are, you know, venerating Templar icons that, you know, go back to the dawn of time. They're basically re-scriptings of the ancient gods Mercury, Herne, Hermes, that, you know, when Druidism was crushed. They crush it, yeah, but they take they suck it first dry of its
content.
They take the wisdom, and then they use that wisdom, they plagiarize it, just like an author plagiarizes, you know, another man's work. Well, these secret societies are vampires. They have sucked Egypt dry. They've sucked the Phoenician kingdoms dry. They've sucked Ireland dry, you see, of its wisdom and its knowledge, and then they set themselves up in this big bogus, you know, edifice that we call the Roman Church. You know, I mean, people have to go to Rome to look around, look at the skulls and bones you see everywhere there, the motifs, the 13 obelisks, all the Masonic symbolism. You see, these are vultures that are perched their edifice over the corrupt, the ruin of the highest cultures that you can imagine. And it's this kind of thing is going on even today, where pretty, you know, intelligent people like the Conan Doyles, you see, and the McGregor Mathers and the Blavatskys of the world come together with a really deep need to try and take human beings up to another level than the simple work utility life of earning your daily bread, you see, and just being industrialists and going about and, you know, opening cotton mills and putting children down the mines, you know, like they did in the 19th century.
Yeah, yeah.
Children didn't even see the light of day. You know, English people, European people looked at the industrial world and just thought it was hell. They thought it was hell on earth when they saw these factories and these, especially in England where you saw the steel mills and
black
the coal mines.
And, yeah.
And sensitive, artistic, mystically inclined people just saw this as the devil loose in the world. You know, destroying souls, destroying human beings.
Yeah, yeah. Oof.
You know, and wanted to take mankind up. You know, Rudolf Steiner used to go around a lot. Did you know that most of Rudolf Steiner's live talks were done to working class people?
No, I didn't
all
know
all over
that.
England, all over Europe, the man worked tirelessly till he died, going around doing free lectures on vegetarianism and on better eating and on spiritual principles to working class men's clubs where he barely got paid. And he worked himself to the bone doing this, trying to educate, you know, people.
Yeah.
Into how to live a better life and get off alcohol and get out of addiction and try to, you know, look up at the stars again, look up at the top of the mountain as opposed to the, you know, the pits of the valley.
Yeah.
Try to change their consciousness.
Huh.
But men like that and women like that, Henrik, have a natural aristocracy. It's not an aristocracy that's bought and paid for. It's not an aristocracy that comes from some bloodline.
Yeah.
It's spiritual, moral aristocracy. And these people are secretly despised by the other shadow aristocracy of the world who have no morality, who are virtueless. So you want to sweep them out from under, and then you want to desecrate their work. So you take their name, you take their titles, you take the work that they have created, and then you build over it, you see.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you know, I mean, there's a wonderful scene in Lord of the Rings where one of the wizards is talking to one of these demonic orcs about the origin of the orcs, and he's saying, do you know the story of the orc? I mean, the orc is basically the most mindless, demonic, you know, being in the story of Lord of the Rings.
Mm.
And the wizard is telling him, once upon a time, you were elves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once upon a time, you were elves that were very pure, and you were like men, but you got crossbred, and this now you're a perfect killing machine.
Yeah.
It's the same idea. Everything that is corrupt, everything that you can put your finger on that is degenerate and corrupt, once upon a time, was the brainchild of some very spiritual person.
Interesting.
And it got corrupt. That's because remember, the dark force cannot create.
Yeah, that yeah, exactly. I've heard that also because there's no creativity in that sense, and that exactly that's why, you know, they have to use other other
right.
means,
and
other methods.
There is only invention. There is no creation.
Yeah.
So they take a creation. Christianity was the creation of the Stoics, a group called the Stoics in Rome. It was a creation of the Gnostics. It was a creation of the Druids. It came out of the cult of Amun-Ra. All of these high principles, which was the most, you know, the Brahmins. Look what the Brahmins are now. Bunch of filthy racists, you know, believing that human beings or even some people are untouchable. But you trace back the story of the Brahmins and you find out that behind that was a very, very sophisticated spiritual cult.
Yeah.
Half the cults of India go back to the old tantric goddess religions of the primordial times. It was an incredible connection to nature, you know, a very beautiful and high thing. Muslimism, some of this terrific masculinized, patriarchal, extremely cruel, sadistic religion, some of the aspects of, you know, the Muslim religion, originally grew out of the most pristine Sufism.
Yeah.
You know, so everywhere we look when we find something rotten and corrupt, at the back of it was some kernel, some tradition that was actually incredibly pure. Sikhism is the same. You know, Christianity is the same. But, you know, the kernel gets lost because, unfortunately, the kernel is only held together by one brain or a very few people. And then if you can remove them, you can remove that class of people, then you can, you know, wield havoc. You can just create havoc. And people then looking back will think, oh, okay, so theosophy is evil.
Yeah.
Or such and such is, or shamanism is of the devil, you know, or, oh, we don't want to be into the Druids, you know.
Yeah.
That's all devil worship.
And
yeah, it is devil worship now, but you haven't seen the whole story of how that thing got corrupted.
Yeah, exactly. And it always feels like, you know, as soon as this kind of cult is created around a person, and it, as you say, I mean, it is a brainchild of that person who kind of holds the energy of the entire concept together, and as soon as the person is gone who had the idea of this, the entire thing either falls apart or turns into something else. But again, I feel this goes back to our, you know, problem that we have to associate with a group every time, and the creation of the cult is something that is actually, you know, I guess the cult eventually breaks down on itself, because I don't know, it feels like people aren't, you know, supposed to be in a cult and just worship a person, so the entire thing eventually kind of pops, I guess.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's very important to not associate with any kind of, you know, collectivized group. You can study it, you can belong for a short time to see what it is.
Yeah.
But you mustn't lose your identity into the thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
And when it comes to leaders like Steiner and Blavatsky and people, we also have another human predicament, and that is idealization.
Yeah.
When we idealize our leaders or anyone who has greatness, we over idealize them.
Yeah.
Nobody is as perfect as we want to make them in our mind. You know, Elvis was a god. No, Elvis was just a great singer, and he operated like any human being.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but not to the fan. The fan thinks this guy is God. You know, he's absolutely, you know, he's Jesus. He's going to save your soul. I mean, you know, people idealize the whole cult of the celebrity.
Yeah.
But people like Blavatsky and all these people aren't to be celebrities. But even in a cult, what happens is that these people start to become totally, totally idealized.
Mm.
And then what's the downside of that? Now that you've idealized that person, should those persons do anything at all that contravenes that projection, they're evil.
Yeah.
Or they have dark sides. Now, this is what has followed Aleister Crowley around, except that Aleister Crowley also kind of fed it as well a little bit. He knew how to play to this particular proclivity of human beings. But he's a good example of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a totally normal human being, you know?
Yeah.
He dated women. You know, he said he spoke his mind. He dabbled around with drugs a little bit, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And he did his normal human thing. But people had idealized him with one side of their brain, so then if anything that he did that contravened that, suddenly he was absolutely the devil's own child.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then he kind of played along with it. Other people can't, and they just cannot believe this. And this kind of phenomena happens in the media. Every other month, you'll find something along this line is happening. You know, look at Martha Stewart case or the Michael Jackson case, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're not perfect. They're ordinary human beings. They're less than perfect. But the media and the people make them even more perfect than they are.
Yeah.
So now, should that person dare to, you know, do anything that breaches convention or takes down this person's idealization, which is loss of self,
yeah.
And that's it. They're going to be absolutely immolated now and blamed and cursed out, you know, for whatever.
Exactly. You have betrayed me because I believed in you or whatever.
That's right. There's so many, in the book by Oscar Wilde, you know, The Picture of Dorian Gray, when the character Dorian Gray is basically, denouncing his fiance, the girl that he is getting married to,
mm-hmm.
He's basically leaving her in the dumps. He's going to dump her, and in fact, this girl actually goes on to commit suicide because she's, you know, thrown aside.
Mm.
In the letter that Dorian Gray writes to her, he says, "You have destroyed my image of you." Right? He's blaming her, saying, "You are not the person that I thought you were.
Yeah. Exactly.
Your memory or the image that you have created, you have not lived up to."
Yeah.
I mean, he's even voicing the fact that the person is disappointed. You know, the great author Thomas Hardy, this was the center of one of his greatest books, which is called The Tests of the D'Urbervilles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, people have to study this book in school. You know, it's a great classic.
Yeah.
Well, the whole theme of that book is this very predicament of guilt.
Yeah.
This whole predicament of that, you know, this poor girl Tess is dumped by her husband.
Mm-hmm.
Even when they're deeply, she imagines that they have this incredible spiritual connection. When this husband finds out that she had actually been raped by a previous, you know, lover against her will, he drops her. And he ruins her life just because in his mind, this girl was violated by another man and therefore wasn't his possession completely.
Amazing.
And that the image that he had put on her of this perfectly pure, innocent, you know, waif-like angel.
Yeah.
Was now, of course, completely the opposite side had happened. So individuals are doing this every single day in their own, you know, in their own world.
Yeah.
I've seen in England personalities TV personalities who were just doing their job and were, you know, on TV programs. There was a guy once who was completely ruined his career. He was a host of a children's program, and one day the media, you know, happened to print that he was found downtown in London at some sort of bar where there was women. Mm-hmm. It wasn't even a gay bar or nothing. This was back in the 1980s, where the guy just happened to be shown at a normal club, sort of drunk. No, I'm not joking. Yeah. And from that moment on, just because of that one breach,
yeah,
because this guy was an idol for, you know, kids, he completely, his career was ruined. He never appeared in anything else again.
Amazing.
So people are doing this on the most basic secular level. What do you think they're going to do when you have world-class minds beyond politics? Politicians come and go in a couple of years. What are you talking about when you have the makers of the new churches, the great theosophical, you know, colleges of the world?
Yeah.
My God, they can never be pure enough.
I mean, could there be, I guess, a plan behind this in the sense that that we have people who are very, you know, aware of the fact that people kind of like their holy cows, so to speak. They are, in other words, if they're setting up celebrity and first and foremost, I guess, political leaders and stuff like this, people are not going to, you know, believe that these people can be, let's say, behind a conspiracy or evil-minded in any way, because people are so used to kind of idolizing people who are in the limelight, as you say.
Well, of course, that's absolutely true. And because we live the kind of mediocre lives on the street level, working every day, it's very difficult to understand what really goes on behind the corridors of power and the kind of allegiances that people do need to cultivate. You see, in the inner world, you may have to shake hands with people you don't like. You may have to sit at the table. You know, we know that politicians have to do that. Well, in occult circles and philosophical circles, it's kind of the same thing. You may have to sit down and even, you know, chat and smile with people that you are absolutely philosophically opposed to.
Mm-hmm.
It can happen. This is the part of the diplomacy that goes on in the circles above us.
Yeah, sure.
In the higher echelons. But you see, I've always been a believer that the greatest damage to the world system is always done from the inside, not from the outside.
Yeah, yeah.
So the smart person who may be on the inside but may be a whistleblower, or he may not identify, he may be even born into the elite, he may be born as a royal, he may be born as a senior mason or whatever, but he may not, and I know many people who are, I'm not going to mention their names ever publicly, but I know many people who've done incredible good. That it's unspeakable the good that they've done.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people who have been part of the system.
Hmm. Yeah.
But they chose another way. Because a million screamers out there with their placards is absolutely no good. You know what all that does? That just makes those people think that they've done something good, and it pacifies them. So they can go home, you know, and put their placard in the cupboard and think, oh, I did a great deal of rebelling today.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't mean anything. The people who really have the power to, you know, destroy the corrupt system work from within. They're lawyers, they're politicians, they're statesmen,
yeah,
they're bankers, they are they're members of the United Nations. One person within the system who then comes out and writes a book or a memoir or who brings, people to trial or whatever, it's from within the system that the greatest damage is done. We must never, ever forget that.
Hmm. Interesting.
So, this is the whole, concept of what I talk about is the agent provocateur, the columnist, working within. So if you are a kind of person who's doing that, then you have to put on the smile. You have to walk with these cutthroats, these death squad people, these Illuminatis, these Masons. You have to work right alongside these businessmen, these military intelligence men who are doing incredible evil.
Hmm.
But you've got to work incognito. And that might mean that you might even, for a while, be mistaken by the general public as one of those kinds of people.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's very interesting to think about that, because some of these people that we may be seeing, and we are saying, oh, this person is, you know, of the dark side. How do you know that? You don't really know.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's true. Of course.
They could be working from within. And this has happened on numerous occasions in which people, especially in the media, and this is absolutely factual, that people even working within the film, within the media, who have been themselves maybe even taught in Jesuit colleges, or have been, their fathers have been members of these Masonic lodges and so on, or high generals in the military, then these other characters go on to make enormous changes because they're doing it through knowledge.
Yeah.
They actually have insider knowledge.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, very interesting. And of course, this kind of brings up another point that I wanted to get to, and this is, of course, regarding, you know, the constant, I guess, infiltration that occurs with different groups of different kinds, because, I mean, I guess, if I'm not mistaken, the Illuminati first, the Bavarian Illuminati was created, one of their goals, I think, was to infiltrate the existing secret societies, right?
Well, yeah, that was the basic plan. Of course, the Illuminati is nothing more than a sort of a tentacle of the Vatican.
Yeah,
not
yeah.
The Vatican as a Roman Catholic would understand it, but the secret club P2 Propaganda Due.
Yeah.
You know, the Club of Rome, the Club of the Isles, these different secret societies that are operating out of Rome, unbeknownst to most Catholics. Yeah, it was them who realized that, you know, they needed to create a counterfeit foe, enemy, you know, sort of a rival. It's better to have a rival paid by yourself than to really have a true rival.
Yeah, exactly.
So they got their own henchmen, one of whom was Adam Weishaupt, to ostensibly set up what was an anti-Catholic organization. And that would attract all these dukes and princes, and scholars and thinkers, you see, who were absolutely completely fed up with the Catholic system.
Mm.
I mean, more than you can even imagine. I mean, these are people who've already endured 100 years war.
Yeah.
You know, people can look up on online dictionary the 100 years war, then look up 30 years war.
Yeah.
You know, then you have your Henry VIII problem where he tries to divide from the Catholic Church. So all the world was really fed up with the way, and they had these peasant revolutions and peasant revolts.
Mm.
You know, a lot of my work is dedicated to Thomas Munzer, you see, and some of these people who, in their own way, stood up against the, back in the 1600s, and even in the medieval times, people who tried to stand up against, you know, the establishment. Well, so the bishops and the top brains knew that one day it is quite possible that their whole hegemony might fall.
Hmm.
So the best thing to do is to create what appears to be a reflection, not a reflection, but an opposite.
Yeah, yeah.
But you pay for it, you fund it. And this is exactly how the Bavarian so-called Illuminati took on their work.
Yeah.
So that they would spend 100 years or so pretending to be an anti-Catholic organization. And it worked wonders. The plan worked better than they could ever imagine. So all the dukes and the princes and the intelligentsia of Europe, you see, start flooding into these secret societies.
Yeah.
And, of course, a lot of these people were already Masonic to begin with.
Yeah.
So when they became members of the Illuminati, it was only a step away where the Illuminati could then basically say, hey, we're Masonic, because almost everybody who's belonging to us are old Masons. So it wasn't more like they came in and really took over. It was more like they themselves were attracting Masons.
Ah.
And then what they did was, the smart move was to put in front of these Masons what appeared to be secret degrees that Masonry didn't have yet. So Illuminati always presented itself, the keepers of the lodges of the Illuminati lodges, they started to work through the Grand Orient lodges of Europe, and they always pretended to have initiations and knowledge that was even more higher than what a normal Masonic lodge, you see, would have.
Hmm. Yeah.
And of course, this at the time was very attractive. You can't even imagine what obsession is when it comes to secrets. You know, the idea of secret knowledge is a very, very obsessive concept.
Yeah, is it Albert Pike who mentions that in Morals and Dogma, that, you know, nothing attracts, you know, men more than secrets, I guess, or mystery,
right.
I think
and
it says.
And this is a key to, you know, in my book, The Irish Origins of Civilization, I go into this a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The promise of secret knowledge, it was very intoxicating in those days,
as
it still is today. And just the idea of privilege and so forth and so on, you know, is very attractive. And this is exactly a combination of different lures. But the biggest lure was that this order was anti-Catholic.
Yeah.
And was ecumenical, and was maybe a little mystical, a little Egyptian, a little spiritual,
mm-hmm.
you know, a little bit debauched even, you know, you can come and play with your, you know, instincts and stuff like that. And this, of course, was tremendously attractive, you know.
Yeah.
And it had Venetian money behind it, and it had royal money behind it now. So, of course, you wanted to join, because all the princes and dukes were funding it.
Yeah.
So all the, you know, young men wanted to become members of this organization because, you know, all the alumni were joining it, and it felt that it was a way to operate and, you know, not be known to Catholicism. Well, guess what? You're in a Catholic organization. You're in an organization that's funded by the Vatican, so everything you do, everything you are is known. They're keeping records on you.
Exactly, yeah.
So we want to know why the world was in today, and people stand up and go, oh, Michael, you can't be serious. No secret society can just come in. come in and take over.
Yeah.
Well, I say back to them, yeah, first of all, it didn't happen like that. And secondly, if you know how these people actually organized it, how they co-opted the intelligentsia of the world and had their whole profile in the palm of their hands, you better believe they can take over.
Exactly.
Don't corporations take over today? Isn't people screaming about the great imperial corporate takeover of America, and America is basically only 150, 180 years old,
yes.
And they're already telling you that within half that time, corporations basically own the world? How can you admit that corporations can own the world, but you can't say that in 2,000 years, secret societies can take over the world?
Exactly.
When for 2,000 years, all there was a bunch of feudal villages. My goodness, people need to wake up. Nothing could have been easier. This thing didn't come in and take over. It owned the world. It already had annihilated anybody who could stand in its way.
Exactly.
And it was already run by dukes and princes and potentates
exactly.
of the highest level.
I mean, that's a difficult concept to get around in a way also. But I think it's true, you know, that they actually have, you know, they have handed down, you know, the entire civilizations, entire, you know, the game plan of the industrial, you know, revolution and all of this stuff also.
Oh, it's all been scripted.
Yeah.
It's all been scripted. You know, and they're so brilliant. I mean, this whole story of you're talking about secret societies and their manifestos, this whole thing of the protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's not the protocols of the Elders of Zion. It's the protocols of the Elders of Sion.
Yeah.
Right? It's
yeah.
the old Atonists. You know, the Levites come from a city in Egypt called Zion.
Zion, oh, okay.
Which is called Avaris.
Hmm.
And that's where Akhenaten, you know, grew up.
Hmm.
So when you see, I mean, people don't, the title alone, the protocols of the learned elders, on Zion.
Yeah.
Elders is a word from Aldar, which is the tree, the you know, like an alder tree.
Ah,
A-L-D-E-R.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? That's a Druidic story. So the elders are the elves or the Aldars. It's like in England, we have a thing called an alder man. You know that? It's like a mayor.
Ah, okay. Yeah, sure.
In Sweden, what's the name for your mayor?
Borgmästare, that's mayor.
It's for a mayor, yeah?
Yeah, sure.
Right. Well, the next one down, or say they can't get a mayor, the next stage down is what they call alderman.
Hmm, okay.
Alderman is the old Druidic priest, alder. You know, they're named after the 13 trees.
Yeah.
So the elders of Zion. And then you realize, okay, they got the Druidic bit in there, then they got the Zion bit in there, which is Judaic, not Jewish. Not Jewish.
Yeah.
When people are running around believing the Nazis saying, oh, look, the protocols is a Jewish document.
Yeah.
About Jewish world takeover, and then they're going and murdering every Jew they can find. What nonsense!
Yeah,
they don't even know how to read. It's, you know, why? Thank goodness. You know, this is a document that is coming from the old Atonist Zionistic, the true Zionistic, you know, brainchild of the world takeover. It's there right in front of everybody.
Yeah,
the works of theosophy are right there. Nobody reads it. You see, the real manifestos of world control are always there in front of everybody. It's always hidden in plain sight.
Yeah.
But people are very... we have so many disinformation agents working in the conspiracy movement.
Yeah.
In the same way we've had them in the New Age movement. And then their books are highly available. So people read that rubbish, you know, which has maybe, what, 60% truth, 40% lie, or 40% lie, and, you know, 60%. And people buy into this, or they watch an hour of some stupid, bogus, you know, so-called... hey, we're going to explain a conspiracy to you on TV program.
History Channel or whatever.
Yeah, which is absolute. I mean, I'm an expert on taking those things apart because those are some of the most rotten, useless shows that actually seed a lot of very deadly, you know, philosophies about Masonry and about all the history of America and stuff like that. They give you maybe, if that, they give you like 1% or 2%, you know, truth. It's very, very minor on how much truth they give you, but they're very subtle.
Yeah.
They're very, very subtle on, you know, they're still running around idealizing people like Francis Bacon, you know, and all this nonsense. My God, if they only knew what these people were all about. And for every Francis Bacon, there is some true genius that the world knows nothing about. Some absolutely fantastic healer or teacher or cosmologist, you know, like Giordano Bruno or whoever, and there's so many more. They're completely thrown by the wayside and people forget about them while the system, you know, idealizes these monsters.
Yeah, exactly. And again, feels like it's so easy to, if you know, if you keep the record straight, let's say as an organization who are into this that we are talking about, if you keep the record straight, then all you have to do is, as you say, flood the market with the bullshit, basically.
Yeah.
And people can't, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and also, again, it's the same old situation where the people who really have done the homework, it takes time to do the homework.
Yeah, it does.
And so then, you know, they work slowly, they work like hermits, you know, so everybody's going to hear a Tex Mars, everybody's going to hear a Jim Mars, but how many people have heard of Yuri Lina?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Now,
yeah.
You want to know about masonry and the connections between masonry and the Vatican, you know, pick up that guy. What about Vicomte Comte de Pont-Sainte, right? This fantastic writer, the Vicomte Comte de Pont-Sainte, who wrote about five or six books in the early part of the 1900s, you know, who exposing every possible connection you can think of between the Vatican and the secret societies. How many, his books are almost unavailable. In the early part of the 1900s, you have Nesta Webster, who wrote about seven or eight of the most incredible books on the world conspiracy. You have Lady Queensborough. You know, you have Eustace Mullins in America.
Yeah.
There's so many authors out there who really went into great depth on this. You have Bill Hughes. You have John Phelps. Phelps, more recently.
Yeah, sure.
You know, people can check out his work, Vatican Assassins.
Yeah.
You know, there are, but Yuri Lina has written a book called
Architects of Deception. Yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
He's, you know, he's a, I think he's from, originally from Russia, of course. And he was on the, one of the top list of the KGB for as many years as, you know, the KGB has been in existence. This man has been hunted. He now lives in Sweden. He's one of the greatest teachers on Freemasonry.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, and he is showing these connections. Yeah. But these connections have been known from the earliest days, you know, because, there, again, there's been whistleblowers, there's been people from within, from inside who've dared to speak the truth, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, one thing I also wanted to try to tie this together with is, I mean, I don't want to, you know, express my worries in that sense that we shouldn't, you know, go, I mean, fight, you know, against whatever for 9/11 truth or anything like that. But could it be also then now to tie this to modern idea or concept that because this movement, if we can call it that, the 9/11 truth movement, also is one of these movements who seems to be kind of be shattered from within with all these different, you know, people with different theories, and we can't talk about this or the other or whatever. And as soon as we, I guess, associate ourselves with one of these groups, again, there we have the danger of it being infiltrated and being, you know, taken apart, basically.
Well, you see, it's two ways of looking at it. The spirit of rebellion is very Aquarian, which means, in layman's terms, it is a thing that scatters a lot. There are many voices. It does appear like a lot of stuff. So people have to get used to that. I know that it can appear to be chaotic, and there's lots and lots of different, you know, it's like the parliament of birds. There's so many voices. But you see, unfortunately, that's a sort of a hallmark of the rebel. In the old tradition, the jester, the joker, you know, the fool, he wears a multicolored coat.
Yeah.
It's got so many facets. So I'm always focused on this concept of the spirit of rebellion coming in. And one of the hallmarks of the spirit of rebellion is that there are the multiplicity of different, you know, points of view, let's say.
Yeah, yeah.
But, and of course, that can be confusing. But what you got to do is take a metaphor from biology. Don't they say that the heaviest brains are the ones who have the most synapses? Right? They say that synapses is the connectors.
Yeah, sure.
Non-linear brains. They say that women's brains are always heavier than men's because women are the ones who can connect disparate things, that are not normally linear connected.
Yeah.
Women's minds have a tendency to be able to synthesize unrelated, seemingly unrelated, you know, phenomena.
Areas. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And so they say their brain is heavier than a man who's more linear, more super rational.
Yeah.
So the brain is already telling you the story. The brain, like the internet, by diversity, by what we would call controlled chaos or whatever, you know, this sort of diversity,
yeah,
is in a way a good thing.
It is.
So a person has to learn how to juggle with it. A person has to learn how to dive into it, become mutable.
Yeah.
We have grown up for hundreds of years in a very Saturnian, very Martian, and I'm using astrological terminology here, so people have to forgive me, but we've come from a very rigid, focused, rational, you know, methodical, linear place.
Yeah.
Hyper-directed, you know. What we need now is an omnidirectional plastic template, a sort of what was called polyphrenic as opposed to monophrenic way of looking at things.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, a lot of people who are coming from that old school, you know, who've been educated like we all have in the normal school, when you go out into the world, into the realm of ideas, it can seem overwhelming. Even to study, the subject of philosophy.
Yeah.
Oh my God! You want to take on something that's, you know, disparate parts?
Yeah.
There's probably nothing out there more, you know, diversified than philosophy.
Exactly. Yeah. And
then, of course, what you're talking about is that, yeah, here's a major trauma that has taken place. Lots of people who never would have looked up from the ground are now wanting information about what on earth is going on. Are we really being duped by our government?
Yeah.
What on earth is taking place? And they've got questions. They've got questions. But the thing is that people are not in love with the questioning. The questioning is coming from a motive and from a place of panic,
yeah,
anxiety, and fear.
Yeah.
So, of course, there's a desire that you're hungry, feed me. I want food right now.
Yeah.
The truth, but these are people who just have a knee-jerk reaction born out of fear, and they're running around, and they're saying, I'll give you an answer. It's the Jesuits. I'll give you an answer. No, it's the Jews. No, wait a minute. It's Bush and his clan, the
yeah,
oil men.
Yeah.
No, wait. It is Al-Qaeda. It's terrorists. No, wait. Right? So it's everybody running around wanting the quick fix.
Yeah, yeah.
And the real boys at the top are having a right laugh looking down with their binoculars because they know the ant cannot see the elephant.
Yeah.
Right? Everyone has their little piece. It's like a broken mirror. Everybody's picking up going, I can see a face.
Yeah.
But you see, the thing is, it's a much bigger picture than this. It's something that takes a lot of time to digest. It's like a good meal. It's like good wine. It's like something that really takes you to savor it.
Mm.
And that kind of vision is not in the majority of the people who are running around with their little cameras and their websites, you see, and their little stories, and running around, you know, and this guy over here has a little, you know, fix on it, and this teacher over here has got a little fix on it, and they're going to tell you their piece. It's all interesting. It's brilliant.
But the person
who has questions must also love the questioning.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
He must love the questioning, and he must love the process that comes to the answer. He cannot be a person who is running around frenetically, you know, just trying to buy into something to make him feel okay on a sensual level.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I totally agree, and I think that was also one of the reasons, of course, why I posed the question in regards to that there are so many different, you know, ideas and theories out there, because one thing that at least I have kind of come to learn during this process of reading a lot of this stuff is that I come to appreciate the diversity of the viewpoints, because I get in contact with myself on one sense, because I have to, you know, difficult to explain, but I can't just, you know, read material and then believe in it. I have to kind of connect with myself and feel if this is true, and if it's, you know, cross-referenced in other works and so forth. But I think that this process is actually developing people a whole lot more if they are able to, you know, take in all of these different viewpoints, basically.
Right. Well, see, the brain can be programmed by experience. So most people's thinking is of the brain.
Mm.
It's like I get programmed, I think with the brain, and therefore the world programs me. People tell me what to do, the media gives me a bunch of pointers, everybody else's philosophy I listen to, because I have nothing inside myself, and I'm being programmed by all that incredible stimuli from out there.
Mm, yeah.
Then there is thinking with the mind. The mind is programmed by history. The mind is racially programmed. It has the ancestral knowledge. It's programmed in a much slower, deeper way. The person who's thinking with the mind is making these connections.
Mm-hmm.
He's not just taking, you know, what comes in the world to turn him on.
Yeah.
Like it's the first time you've ever heard it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That person is observing the knowledge, observing all the stimuli that comes in, the different voices that are out there, you know, I'm kind of lucky because I grew up in a very eclectic background, you know, with so many different divergent parts. You know, I'm over here, you know, when I grew up, I was in Ireland, of course, so my father was very involved in politics. So you had the Protestants and the Catholics, the Republicans and the gunmen, you know,
yeah,
the Marxists and the
yeah,
communists, you know, the capitalists. So, and then my mom was from India, so we had this whole other mystical thing going on.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I grew up in a whole bunch of different voices. All of that stuff was around me, you know. Lots and lots of voices. Also spent a lot of time in London, so there was a very cosmopolitan background, you know. By the time I was 9 or 10, I must have, you know, known literally tens of thousands of people.
Hmm.
you know, because this was the bohemian days in the 60s. My parents were very active socially. They were super social people.
Yeah.
You know, they had no private life whatsoever. It was always friends and parties and going to political rallies and movements, you know. It was that age. So me as a little child, you see, was exposed to everything. People from Colombia, people from Africa, people from China, Russia, you know, all sorts of different walks of life. Highly intellectual people from the top universities of England and Ireland, you know, and then working class people as well.
Yeah.
Gypsies, you know, people on the soap boxes. So it helped me develop this kind of synthetic type of ability to, you know, observe all the different parts and sort of just see what ones were, you know, making sense to me or whatever, and then you draw your own conclusions.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But the great, you know, activist over in America, Bo Greitz, Lieutenant James, Colonel Bo Greitz, he ran for president several times in America. He's a very, very interesting man. He, in his presidential, you know, campaigns, he always used to stand up and say, and he's the guy who exposed, like, the Golden Triangle, you know, connections to the Bush dynasty and to the Reagan dynasty. He blew open a lot of incredible secrets. And, of course, they dealt with him, you know, trying to get him off, try to blacken his name and so on.
Yeah.
He said one thing I really agree with. He said that, he, and he talked always, he always addressed this thing of diversity. And he said that you haven't, in this life, you must try to get your hands and your arms around all the information that's out there about a particular subject. You must get it all together and bring it into your house and then sit there and sift through it.
Yeah.
You know, and what you do is you use your reason. You use your apparatus of reason, you put it in front of the light of reason, and you try to examine it just like a gold prospector, you know, will slowly sift out the sand to find out what is pristine, what is the gold, and then you have something of value.
Yeah.
The information is not valuable. It's only valuable when it comes in through your own filter, when you subject it to the, you know, your own reason.
Yeah.
And then you really have something, something precious that can then, you know, go on to talk to the world.
Yeah, I totally agree, because otherwise, again, people are just thrown, you know, between the different viewpoints, and they can, you know, as easily as they actually stumble upon the truth, they can again, you know, stumble upon some lie and go in that direction instead.
Yeah, well, Winston Churchill said that in every single human being's life, every human being will at one point or another slam right into truth. They'll hit truth and fall over it.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said that in every case, everyone gets up, dusts himself off, and moves on as if nothing ever happened.
Yeah,
that's amazing. He's got a brilliant thing.
Yeah.
Everybody will have the truth hit them in their life. They'll always meet somebody, or they'll read something, or they'll live in a particular time in which a great truth gets thrown up in their face, or they'll go through a personal dark night of the soul. And for some bizarre reason, people are all, you know, sort of pretending that they're into that, and they change their life and they change their ways and they're never going to be the same again. And then 5 minutes later, they're right back to the same old narcissistic, you know, game.
Yeah.
Like we were saying on one of the earlier programs about these parents who grew up in the 60s and they're all activists and everything, you know. And they can pull out their tie-dyes and show you their VW vans and how free and rebellious they were. And then they're feeding their kids processed meat from the Safeway and sending them to the state school.
Yeah.
You know, 25 years later.
Yeah.
Or worse, they've got their own corporate tie on, and they're working for Big Brother. You know, how much rebellion was in that, you see?
Yeah.
So we have this question of mass, of human hypocrisy to deal with. It goes to the heart of, you know, so many other questions.
Absolutely. And to kind of finish things off here, I mean, do you think that also this is a sign of the times, so to speak, that we are actually in this period now when a whole lot of this information is coming out, and the point of it also is that, you know, we shouldn't allow ourselves to think that there is such a thing as an easy fix or a quick explanation, that actually this demands something of us, and that is that we have to get in contact with ourselves and actually, you know, grow up basically and get smart.
Oh yeah, well, see, everyone knows that there are adult people who have the IQ of like a teenager.
Yeah.
It's a well-known fact. You can even meet people who are like that. You can meet children who are, you know, barely 7 years of age and they're incredibly wise.
Yeah.
So obviously there are different levels of maturity and different levels of acumen and different levels of development and intelligence on all the four levels. A person can be a really good athlete, but they may not be very good intellectually. Another person may be a tremendous intellect, but he may, you know, physically be like a weed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you can blow him down in the wind.
Yeah.
So we have all different kinds of levels of person. What's happening in the world right now, from America all the way across the world, is the emotional growing up.
Mm.
Man has technologically so advanced. Intellectually, he's very, very advanced. Physically, he's a genius. You know, he can climb to the top of Everest. He can dive to the, you know, bottom of the oceans.
Yeah.
He can, you know, do all sorts of skiing and weightlifting and all this other nonsense, right? He's a genius.
Yeah.
He can, you know, walk single-handed across Australia,
yeah.
Go to the Arctic with a team of dogs, you know. I mean, there's nothing physical that the person cannot do.
True,
but
yeah.
Emotionally, the human race is utterly primitive.
Hmm.
So all that is happening now is coming under the Pluto.
Yeah.
Pluto, Uranus, these longer-moving planets in astrology, these are symbols of the change that is coming in.
Mm.
You know, on a greater level, it's to do more with the Holy Spirit and the, you know, age of the spirit of rebellion, but that's a different story, and we've talked about it before, but
yeah.
On a little bit different level is that now the whole human race is having to face the fact that for all these other developments and all this other maturity that it's got, it is not emotionally developed.
Hmm.
People like me come in and say, that's because you've been artificially held back by church, religion, state. People can believe that, or they can not believe it. It's totally up to them.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it's true that human beings would have already been very much, you know, more mature emotionally and spiritually if the shamans and the Gnostics, you see, and the Druids had been ruling our societies. And the reason why we would have been more mature is because shamanic people don't allow you to not grow. They kick you in the ass. They make sure that the civilization, you see, is purified, goes through its rituals, and it purges its dark content. That's what a shaman does. It makes sure that the tribe or the person goes through these, you know, spiritual catharses. That's all been removed hundreds of years ago.
Mm.
So now man's development is arrested. What's happening now is that these planets are coming in like dark mirrors to try and show you that, look, you've got to handle and deal with all of this stuff.
Yeah. And now
there's still, you know, intellectual development is still going to be part of that, of course. And so on. But you see, man has more flavors of ice cream than he's ever had before.
Yeah.
You know, he's got more kinds of Porsches than he's ever had before. There's 100,000 different magazines on every little subculture that you can imagine.
Yeah.
All the sensational, physical, bodily, you know, mental needs are basically taken care of.
Yeah.
And plus, and more.
Absolutely.
You know, there's not a single thing you can think of that hasn't been created. But see, emotionally, we're in like a desert.
Now it's going to, you know, the floodgates are going to open, I guess.
Man cannot live in an imbalanced way. Carl Jung, Freud, they said it, that if you try to be on a boat that's leaning so far over because one part of you is not developed enough, you know, then you're going to end up, you know, inheriting tragedy.
Mm.
And it's mostly of a spiritual, emotional level that people are arrested because they've had false religion, false teachers, false schools, false, you know, teachings, all the rest of it, and not dealing with this true emotional, spiritual aspect of human life. And what is happening now is that things are becoming so dark spiritually and emotionally, is that is going to hopefully be a catalyst. So I'm never pessimistic, you see.
Yeah.
First of all, I don't focus on the future. So, you know, the future is unimportant. What is important is what people do now.
No, yeah.
You know, and I do believe that what is happening now, the spirit of rebellion, is an assister. It is a catalyst. It's assisting us to remove those impediments that I was talking about that stand in the way of a man's development.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not just individuals who are to blame about their, you know, lack of emotional and spiritual development. It's because you had a huge weight. Do you remember in the talk that I did in Los Angeles, I said, it's not so much, have you been sold a lie? The question is, have I bought a lie?
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's
so it's the same problem, but you just look at it slightly differently.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Taking responsibility that, wait a minute, yeah, there's maybe an adversary out there, but I didn't have to buy it. I could have slammed the door in its face.
Yeah.
How come I welcomed it into my life?
Yeah,
so there's disease and all my relationships are broken and, you know, the life I live is mediocre. We got to start looking and realizing that you're not letting go of anything that's worth 2 cents.
Yeah, that's
so true. The fear and the anxiety comes around in people because they're thinking that they're going to lose something of value.
Yeah.
My message is, you ain't got nothing of value to lose. So if the Illuminati wants to take it, give it to it. Let it have it. There's nothing you have right now that is of real value except a lie. Step out of that mold, you see, into something more real.
Yeah.
That's what this adversarial force is really trying to teach you. Yeah, it's
and
a lesson.
Yeah, and then the ego and all of this wants to hold on to it because
yes.
That's what, you know, defines it. So
this is it. The ego is acquisitive and fixated.
Yeah.
It's arrested. It's regressive. It stays conservative with a thing. It doesn't move. It doesn't progress unless it's trauma. Because remember, the birth of the ego is trauma.
Mm.
So any little birth or any rebirth or any movement forward, only the ego will do it out of trauma, out of flight and fight.
Yeah.
But there's a better way to be. And, of course, because the ego's like that, then society becomes like that. Society only moves forward when there's a panic, when there's emergency, when there's tremendous tribulation.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the ego working on several different levels. But, you know, the message of the shaman is that, look, wait a minute, you don't have to do it that way. There are other ways in which you can progress that are much more, you know, holistic and sophisticated. And understand that you're in a hierarchy. All you're giving up is your chains. There's nothing that the world, there's no challenge that the fate throws at you that you cannot handle.
Yeah. And we will, Michael, we've got to finish up here to keep the format, but we this is definitely something, you know, that we are going to, I guess, also return to and tie into a lot of things as we, you know, continue in the months and our ongoing series ahead here.
Sounds good. Yeah,
absolutely.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Absolutely. I mean, again, thank you so much for being here, Michael, and we will talk soon again, okay?
Okay, all the best.
All the best. Thank you.
Bye.
You have been listening to Red Ice Creations Radio. Thank you for being a subscriber. Your support keeps redicecreations.com alive. Until next time, take care.